Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM. It's Tuesday, the 16th of May, and it's Caoimhe Hearney with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Dr. Chris Luke. He's an emergency physician. Overwhelmed emergency departments are struggling with the number of drug-related cases. We'll get the news there. Then we'll speak to John Clendenin, incoming Vintners Federation of Ireland president. Nearly three quarters of publicans outside Dublin have recovered from the pandemic. We'll speak to Susanna Morrissey. She's wellbeing coach and mindfulness expert at Om Wellness in Johnstown. She'll be giving us tips on supporting teens through exam season. And then we'll speak to Pat Kane, sustainability expert and founder of Roozy, a sustainability lifestyle shop. Fast fashion is contributing a lot to environmental degradation. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, 045 898 999. If you want to email me, it's studio at kfmradio.com. Or, of course, you can send me a text or a WhatsApp.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, emergency departments are overstretched and are finding it increasingly difficult to deal with the number of drug-related cases presenting at emergency departments. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Dr. Chris Luke. He's an emergency physician. Good afternoon, Dr. Chris.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe. I should clarify that I'm actually retired, semi-retired. I'm retired from seeing patients. I'm now lecturing and writing mainly.
Okay, perfect. Thanks very much for that. I suppose you're on today because the Citizens Assembly on Drugs has been visiting around treatment centres in Dublin today to meet the service users and the staff. Can you give us a little bit of information about that? And I suppose your experience in emergency departments then?
Yes, I wasn't actually on the tour. I was actually speaking at the Citizens Assembly on a panel of frontline workers with a paramedic, a Garda officer, and a treatment nurse specialist from Merchants Quay. So really, along with my three colleagues, I was offering a sort of personal perspective on what it's like when drug cases are brought in to overcrowded emergency departments. And I suppose the first point I made was that I think everybody by now realizes that all our emergency departments are overwhelmed for most of the 24 hours, you know, basically 24/7, almost every day of the year. And the old idea that you know, there were extra pressures in the winter, I think that's gone by the wayside now, and people realize that all our EDs are overwhelmed. So that was the starting point. And then into those conditions where there are people on trolleys everywhere in bursting waiting rooms, you can get people brought in by ambulance, you know, with drug-related issues. And they, I suppose, break down into four groups. I mean, you know, you can be talking about any drug, but we were particularly talking about cannabis, cocaine and alcohol, I suppose, along with the opioids like heroin or methadone. That's sort of are seen by paramedics on the streets. And really, in a nutshell, there's four groups. The first group really is the acute intoxication. So, you know, we've all seen people who are intoxicated with the drink. Some young people particularly can be very intoxicated with cannabis and can be, you know, be very frightened, can have hallucinations and can be very, 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 very agitated and paranoid. And obviously with cocaine, you can be very, very agitated as well. And you can occasionally have sudden stroke, epilepsy, seizures, heart attacks, or not uncommonly, people can become very violent. They have a kind of reaction to the cocaine. And obviously with overdoses, acute overdoses with opioids, people stop breathing. They have pinpoint pupils. They may be very grey or blue in appearance, and they can often respond very well to the famous antidote, Narcan or Naloxone. Mm-hmm. The next group of people with drug-related presentations are the chronic or, you know, repeat users, the ones who use a lot of drink or drugs. And again, most of us know what that looks like. We're looking then at chronic mental illnesses like addiction, psychosis, homelessness, repeat presentations, people being found on the street either drunk or intoxicated or with obvious overdoses. The third group then would be withdrawal. So almost every drug or drink that, you know, when you have acute withdrawal, will lead to a similar pattern of, you know, shaking, trembling, agitation, delirium, and sometimes, you know, violent combativeness. And then, of course, the fourth and perhaps most tragic group are those who are affected by the user. So that can be people who are assaulted on the streets by people who are intoxicated, the family members who see the decline in their loved one's general well-being or mental health, and so on.
Okay, it's very interesting, very serious by the sounds of things. You mentioned there, Dr. Luke, at the outset about cannabis. How would that affect people presenting at the emergency department?
Well, we suspect that between 10 and 20% of heavy users of cannabis, you know, are talking... Now, you know, we're not talking about the odd spliff here. Mm. We're talking about people who are smoking probably several joints every day. That in that group of people, between 10 and 20% of them can develop a dependency or what's called a cannabis use disorder. And that, of course, is where they have cravings for more cannabis. They develop a tolerance, so they need to smoke more or eat more or whichever way they take it to get the same hit. And then you have the sort of basically the development of what people understand as addiction. That just, you know, everything, you know, their whole day revolves around getting hold of their cannabis. And the same applies, obviously, to drink and opiates and benzodiazepines and whatever. Obviously, we will see people who we'll see the whole spectrum in the emergency department, from people who are homeless because of a chronic drug or drink habit. Or whose parents had chronic drug. I mean, this is another thing we have to remember, is that, you know, drugs and drink can have a multi-generational impact. And we've often heard Father Peter McCleary, you know, the Peter McCleary Trust founder, talking about how he is seeing the grandchildren of the first heroin addicts, you know, in Dublin back in the 70s and 80s. And so you have multi-generational trauma. People who are, you know, people who are using drugs or drink can be very neglectful. There may be episodes of domestic violence. You know, again, it's nothing there that's not well known to your listeners. In terms of cannabis, as I say, heavy cannabis use can be associated with mental illness. So you can have occasional episodes of florid psychosis. So, you know, what looks like an acute episode of schizophrenia with hallucinations, delusions, agitation, paranoia, basically seeing or hearing things that aren't there, or having very fixed beliefs that, you know, there's voices, they can hear voices. That's not unusual. And of course, then everything else in between, you can have what's called cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, CES, which is something that they're seeing a lot of in those parts of the States and Canada where they've legalized cannabis and the consumption rates have gone up. Along with the increased consumption rates, you see more and more people being brought into the emergency departments in places like Colorado or California with this cyclical vomiting. You get particularly typically young adults who have, you know, marked abdominal pain and constant vomiting, which is only helped by having hot showers. And that hot shower, you know, cure was eventually, you know, associated with the cyclical vomiting diagnosis after, you know, emergency physicians like myself saw, you know, dozens of cases over a period of a couple of years after they started to legalize cannabis around the States. And of course, then you have things like, you know, we've seen recently where youngsters, children get hold of these edible cannabis gummies or jellies that are left around if, for example, their guardians or their parents are themselves intoxicated with drink or cannabis or whatever. And children have been brought into, for example, Temple Street in the last couple of years. We've seen repeated reports in the newspapers and in the medical literature about such cases. And the children, of course, can be as young as 4, 5, 6, and they're, you know, they can become very frightened because they are experiencing a kind of mini psychosis as well, with hallucinations, and it can be very terrifying for the children and, of course, for the parents, and difficult to calm them down.
Can I take it then, Dr. Luke, that you would be against the legalizing of cannabis in this country?
Well, that's a very binary question, Priva. I don't know whether, you know, my answer would be very nuanced. I would like to see more research into cannabis coming from the States, particularly those states where they've legalized cannabis, and I'd like to see them using the opportunity of the decriminalisation or legalisation there to turbocharge their research. I'd particularly like to see more use or more research into the use of cannabis, for example, in palliative care. I think that the role of cannabis is most likely to be in palliative care, and then perhaps in areas that we've seen already, you hints of multiple sclerosis, certain types of refractory childhood epilepsy, some pain syndromes and so on. But, you know, we do need a lot more research because obviously, because it was illegal for so long, we didn't see very much research. I'm not a great fan, in fact, I'm not a fan at all of, I suppose, easy criminalisation. I don't think people should be criminalised for possession of small amounts. And because I don't think that many people in this country are actually criminalised when they're teenagers found with small amounts, you know, for their own use. So I think the idea of criminalisation is perhaps overblown in the debate. I know it's difficult if people get a criminal record, but I think that only happens when there's repeated arrests for possession or dealing of non-personal amounts and so on. So my answer would be very nuanced, Cleaver. You know, and I don't think I'd like to be painted into a corner about that. I think we're going to see more and more legalisation, but unfortunately, we're likely to see more and more issues with cannabis because that's what happens when you legalise a drug. We've seen it with tobacco, we've seen it with alcohol, we've seen it with benzodiazepines, we've seen it with antibiotics and on and on and on it goes. We even saw it there, for example, with drugs like sulfadine or distalgesic, you know, the codeine drugs. So regulation is very imperfect. Education is pretty poor as well. And for that reason, you know, legalisation, I certainly don't see legalisation as a sort of simple solution that many people advocate.
In your professional opinion, would you view cannabis as a gateway drug to other drugs?
Well, I think all drugs are gateway drugs. You know, I think if you have 10 pints of Guinness and someone offers you a spliff, you're much more likely to take it than if you had no drink. Mm. Similarly, if you smoke tobacco when you're 14, it seems much more likely that you smoke a joint. So the use of one tends to use another. And if you're a person who believes that there's a pill for every ill, then again, you're more likely to take pills regularly, you know, for non-medical reasons. So, you know, in that sense, I think that all drugs are potential gateway drugs.
Okay, this Citizens' Assembly is running until October, I understand. Obviously, many, many people like yourselves, people in the professions and other, I suppose, stakeholders talking about different things.
I suppose, Cuiva, if I was to say one thing, and I think this is really, really important, I've spent, you know, 35 years in the front line, in inner cities, in Liverpool, Edinburgh, Dublin and Cork. And the solution of the legislation, legalisation and education, a school of thinking, is always basically legalise, educate, regulate and, you know, and reap the rewards of the tax. But we know from experience before that the tax on the sales of cannabis is very, very, it's considerably less than predicted, for example, in New York, where it has been legalized recently. And it doesn't match the human or healthcare costs. And the most important thing is here, Cleaver, the people who suffer most really are, in terms of cannabis use disorder, will tend to be young teenage males who can really have severe long-term mental health problems with heavy use of cannabis. And adolescent mental health facilities and services in this country are absolutely shockingly inadequate as it is. And we've been pleading for more adolescent mental health facilities in Ireland for the bones of two or three decades now. And sadly, the thing I worry most about is if we see more cannabis use, and there's a lot of cannabis use in this country as it is, if we see even more, then we're going to see even more mental health problems with adolescent males particularly. And at the moment, it's reckoned that there's about 45,000 people, young adults with cannabis use disorder, many of them who are in need of mental health services. And of course, those services just aren't there.
Okay, Dr. Chris Luke, retired emergency physician and, of course, lecturer. Thank you very much, Chris, for your time.
Kildare Focus with Cuíomh Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, a new survey shows that the vast majority of publicans are confident about the future of their bars, and almost three quarters of publicans outside of Dublin say turnover is now similar or greater than pre-COVID, with many expected to upgrade their pubs in the coming year. Well, I'm joined now on the line by John Clendenin. He's incoming Vintners Federation of Ireland president. Good afternoon, John.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you today?
Very good, John. I understand, John, you're holding your AGM today.
Absolutely. We're gathered in Knight's Folk Hotel in Trim today with over 300 publicans in attendance, I suppose, discussing the future of the pub and the results of the recent survey that you just referenced there at the outset of the piece. And I suppose there's a sense of cautious optimism in the air. The results of the survey found that the majority of publicans, 7 in every 10, were looking at a profit compared to 2019, increases in turnover, and there's a cautious optimism out there. But I suppose it does come with a sense of cautious optimism, and that if you look at February 2020 where we were and what happened the following month and all of the disruption that was unfolded over the couple of years after, I think, you know, right now what we're seeing is probably the benefits of investment in our properties over the course of the pandemic, to increase capacity, introduce new initiatives, and diversity in products and service offering, and thankfully, you know, there has been a response from consumers, but I think it just showcases the point that, you know, we need to stay in touch with what consumers want and continue to deliver something that will have an appeal. But I think it also must be noted that, you know, not every publican is reporting a profit. There are challenges out there, and I think if you look at, you know, some of the issues around the cost of energy, inflation, insurance, and from a legislative perspective, issues such as VAT and hospitality rate of VAT and sale of alcohol bill, there are issues coming down the track that we're going to have to address to ensure viability in the trade, that the trade remains feasible, and that it's attractive to new entrants in terms of investing in the pub sector.
A strong bounce back then after COVID there, and I suppose it'll be needed ahead of the increase in the VAT rate back to the original 13.5% in September. What are your thoughts on that, John?
Yeah, well, look, from a pub's perspective, you know, drink sales are at 23%, so it doesn't necessarily predominantly affect all our members. But, you know, I think it is important to note that, you know, in situations where pubs are serving food and have accommodation, that it has acted as an important stimulus to ensure activity. And you know, quite frankly, if, you know, support such as the support that we saw over COVID, the likes of energy support schemes and the likes of the VAT rate, you know, if measures like that weren't in place, I'm not so sure we'd have figures as high as we have at the moment in terms of the confidence in the trade. And I think, you know, that they have brought confidence to an extent and a level of stability. And it's important from that perspective that, you know, the likes of the hospitality rate will be maintained in order to ensure growth and stability, you know, in every town and village across rural Ireland in particular, that would have, you know, an interest in the tourism sector.
Okay, John, I suppose then you're going to be campaigning to keep the 9% VAT rate, will you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's imperative that we do, and it has shown its importance, you know, in recent times, and I think that will be our position going forward.
Right. I have to say, John, anecdotally here, we do get a lot of anger in regards to the 9% VAT rate, particularly because people feel like in many pubs, not all, but that prices aren't really reflective of what they should be. They feel they're being, you know, price gouged. We've had a few people across Kildare where, you know, they've gone into a restaurant and the cheapest bottle of wine they can buy is €40. They get a glass of Prosecco that's like half flat and it's 12.50, €13. How can you justify that VAT rate then?
Yeah, well, a bottle of wine would be 23%, so it wouldn't be related to the VAT rate of 9%. Food, on the other hand, would be at 9% and accommodation. But I think focusing on the 23% in particular, you know, I think it must be noted that, you know, we have seen increases from suppliers in recent months, and, you know, our members would have been forced to increase prices. But at the same time, wouldn't have increased the prices to the full extent of the margin that might have been there historically in a lot of pubs. And I think also it has to be noted that in terms of innovation and product diversity and the overall offering,
you know, once upon a time, 15, 20 years ago, a pub was literally a place where you went and had a couple of drinks. Whereas now, in terms of that diversity that's there, it's everything from, you know, sports, live entertainment, cocktails, electric car charging stations, craft beers, and so on. And all that, you know, entails investment. It involves a commitment financially from the owner. And more often than not, that comes from margins and impacts the bottom line in terms of profit and isn't totally reflected in the top line price. So I think it certainly, from our perspective, margins have been eroded over time. And it is, you know, even though we're reporting profits today, you know, there are challenges to maintain that. And, you know, that's likely to be the same going forward.
OK, John Clendenin, incoming Vintners Federation of Ireland president. Thanks very much, John, for your time. Now, you might have a child who is going through some exams, and of course we are going into exam season now. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Susanna Morrissey. She is a wellbeing coach and a mindfulness expert at Om Wellness in Johnstown. Good afternoon, Susanna.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe. Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you on, Susanna. Listen, I suppose it's something that all parents will have to go through at some stage, but it can be quite difficult for parents, especially for parents, I think, whose children might err on the side of not studying, Susanna.
I absolutely agree. And I often wonder, is it the parents taking the leave and cert or the children taking the leave and cert? It seems to be kind of overreaching kind of goals. I suppose the first thing to look at in terms of everybody is that everybody's an individual, and to stop comparing yourself is the first tip to anyone else. So your child, I suppose, is unique. Your adult even is unique at this stage, and they have their own study goals and their own plan. Now, if they are not going to be an academic, it is not the end of the world. There are so many ways to get what you want. They say we have 7 careers in each of us. So literally, it's just a process of doing the exam.
Okay.
And I think that's a really important thing, that not every child is academic.
Okay.
Or every young adult is academic, and it doesn't have to be what your neighbour is. It's about you bringing out the best for your person, you know. So I think, first of all, to stop comparing yourself to others. I think that's key.
Okay.
It's a key piece of advice, and basically to let you know that you have to, at this stage, the hard work's been done, and
okay,
it's just bringing in the last bit. Myself, my son is taking it on, and you know, there's so many different personalities and abilities in Leaving Cert, and we all have something wonderful in us, you know. So I suppose it's just an exam at the end of the day. So I think the first thing is to look at your own study goals and to set up your own plan, and then know when enough is enough.
Okay,
From
a parent's point of view then, if their child is going around saying things like, oh, I'm so stupid, or I'm rubbish at everything, or I'll never be able to pass this exam, the advice there is kind of, you know, don't rush in and say, no, you're brilliant, you know, with this kind of toxic positivity, because really you don't know if they're going to pass the exam, and you should just let them have that moment.
That's really a really good question, actually. And I think the first thing is to meet that person where they're at. To acknowledge that. So acknowledge, like, I know that you have doubts, you know, of where you are, but let's just do our best. Let's just get the best out of the situation. And I have total trust in you. I have total confidence in you. Because really, we have no control as parents. You can try to exert control, but the work has been done. I think it's supporting. It's saying, I believe in you. You know, I trust you. The right thing will come for you. And that I think, acceptance of whatever will happen is really important, because generally people do better in the Leaving Cert than they think, as compared to mocks anyway, hopefully. So I think that is the key, that not to have the language of, as you say, that toxic, oh, you're great and you're amazing at maths. What's your goal? Like, what do you think you want to get out of this? And if somebody says, well, I want to get a H4, H5, I want to get a whatever it is, that's your goal. And that's what you go for. And you don't have to explain to anyone else, and support that person, because the students know their ability. Mm-hmm. I think students know what they're capable of more than the parents, to be honest. So I think the parents just have to support that goal and not try to, you know, I suppose, put a round peg in a square pole or square hole, you know, be supportive that
Another
way.
Thing, Susanna, for parents, and I think probably a lot of people would be guilty of this, to be a good role model. So, you know, you can't expect your child to be, you know, stress-free, organised, free of anxiety if you're going around, you know, like a headless chicken. I suppose you want to model what you want your child to have in yourself.
That's a really good point. Yes, absolutely. So it starts at home. You know, home is the nucleus. It's kind of where we leave in the morning to go to school or go to study. So for the leave-in certer, the key is to have a calm environment. So try not to have drama. There's enough drama in the house. So emotions, you know, you need to have a conversation with everybody in the house. So this is number one's priority for the next couple of weeks. No drama, you know, take it outside. We don't need it here. And also, you know, building in a bit of mindfulness. And I know a lot of teenagers out there going, oh my goodness, the last thing I want to do now is to take a pause. But if you can teach them to sit with a great technique, I've taught a lot of students doing exams, is counting breath, Kriva. It's a super one to just show how to model calmness. And it's so simple that it doesn't have to be too woo-woo, if you like. So just say, here's a breath. Here's a counting breath that I like to use when I feel a bit stressed. So model it, like you said. Start at 20, take a deep breath in for 20, and then you exhale for 19. You take a deep breath in for 18, and you exhale for 17. And you take a breath in for 16, and you exhale for 15. And
I'm going to fall asleep on air here now.
So it's literally starting at 20 and getting down to zero. Now, the mind may race and get interruptions, but you just pick a number that you think you're at. So it's just centering the student back on the path. So if there's overthinking and anxiety, which is huge, the counting breath from 20 to zero, you can bring some affirmations into that towards the end. You know, I am doing my best. I bring the best out of myself. You know, I trust myself. Something in those counting breath, you can say an intention. And I like to model that. I show them. You know, I showed my son sometimes a little bit reluctantly, but he took it on board.
I was going to say, how is he receptive to these?
Well, he has no choice. He has to be. I mean, I know he has used some of the techniques, but I think just making it an accounting way, just count your breaths. It's easier than just kind of going into the whole thing. And if you feel that your nerves get the better, if you just try this 20 to zero, and I promise everything will be good.
Okay.
And it's that simple.
Before I let you go, Susanna, the last thing that they're saying here is that you should really maintain the family routine even through exams. So not to be making it all, oh, there's an exam today, there's this, like, just try and keep it like your regular day-to-day life and not to be making a big deal out of it.
Yes, I think it's about minimising it as well. I think it's about having everything in perspective, Akriva, as you say there. So try not to say that this is the day that you know, try not to have that kind of build up. Keep your routine, keep everything as normal as possible, normalise it, if you like. Playtime, I think we spoke about this last week, about the playtime, but switch off every day is really important. Still bring the dog for a walk in the afternoon or go for a swim and get out in the outdoors now, especially now, so that it doesn't feel so homey, you know, because I think a lot of schools have stopped now towards the end of the week and it's study time. So it is time to kind of have a good routine in the morning, but then afternoon, take a couple of hours off. You need the 2-3 hours to get out there and play football or whatever it is, to normalise the whole thing, and then everything feels less overwhelming.
Okay, Susanna Morrissey, wellbeing coach and mindfulness expert at Wellness in Johnstown. Thanks very much, Susanna, for your time. Now, moving on to more important matters, Pat Kane, sustainability expert and founder of Roosie, a sustainability lifestyle shop, is on the line and he'll be telling us about how fast fashion is contributing to a lot of environmental degradation. Good afternoon, Pat.
Hi, how are you, Kriva?
Not too bad. Pat, listen, I suppose this has all been prompted from Shein's new headquarters in Dublin and there's been a lot of talk from Fianna Fáil MEP Barry Andrews about how this will, you know, put things in question. It'll ruin Ireland's reputation on the line in terms of environmental aspects. And I don't want to go too much into that, but from your side, you know, how do you feel about fast fashion and the way things are going here?
So fast fashion is always a challenge, right? We're not only looking at the environmental, I suppose, degradation, but we're also looking into challenges around, you know, labour conditions and just human rights in general. Fast fashion brands will always rank lowest, you know, in terms of transparency and sustainability. And there are always several accusations made, you know, about companies like Shein, for example, around labour rights and, you know, like basically average pay and basic, I suppose, basic needs from workers. So always a very challenging one. From my side, I would love to see our government pushing for more support, you know, local brands, helping them generate jobs, helping them thrive. You know, they're incredible brands here in Ireland doing great work. But right now, they don't have the visibility or the power to grow. So if we could put all of that attention towards, you know, our own, I suppose, homegrown brands, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Absolutely. In terms of fast fashion then, and some of the shops or stores that might be, you know, on the worst scale, now I don't want to get too much into it, but is mm-hmm. there big brands out there that maybe people think are okay, but really they are a part of these fast fashion brands?
I think without mentioning names, you know, and I'm sure people can think of a name or two as we talk, as we go through this, you know, everywhere you can find, you know, a T-shirt for a fiver or even less, that is considered fast fashion, right? You are probably looking into millions of pieces being released every year by those brands. You know, there are brands that are releasing up to 5,000 new styles every week, which is crazy, right? To think about, and I'm talking about styles, not necessarily talking about quantity of products. So, and you know, so we're looking at crazy numbers, and yet the people behind that production, they are the ones, paying the true cost, right?
Absolutely. I read something there recently, Pat, about how, you know, maybe 50 years ago, 60 years ago, there was four different, you know, styles, I suppose, or seasons within a year. And now, with the rise of fast fashion, there's nearly like four or five micro seasons within one season. Mm. So summer will have five, or, you know, winter will have five. And again, it's all about, you know, consumption and buying as much as you can.
Yeah. It is. Like right now, every week is a season. You know, if you go online on websites where people would shop for that sort of, suppose, you know, range around like fast fashion, you will look at on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, you will see new styles coming in. And so every week is a season right now, right? Mm. It's all about looking into that overconsumption, overproduction first, and then overconsumption, and trying to think, right, do we actually need those things? People often ask me, you know, what are the sustainable brands out there? And the best brand you have, let's call it, is your wardrobe, is the stuff you already own, right? That's the most sustainable option of all. So it's about either shopping your own wardrobe, buying secondhand. There are incredible websites and shops in Ireland, charity shops and all, you know, offering a great range of products. It's all about swapping with friends, breaking that awkwardness, you know, just being the first one on your family group on WhatsApp or your friends group and saying, hey, guys, I'm looking for XYZ. Anybody would like to swap? I have these bits here that I no longer need or want. You know, break the awkwardness. It's fine. You know, it's about keeping things in circulation without creating this crazy production of new products that are not only obviously harmful for our environment, for the obvious reasons they end up in the bin, right? Mm. And there's no such thing as away. So they will end up somewhere. But also, it's really bad from a labor point of view. We're exploiting people in places that we will never potentially get to see around the world. But yeah, they are struggling to make ends meet because they're not making enough to cover for, you know, their own expenses. Mm. Yet they are working 7 days a week.
Yeah, Pat, I suppose the upside of it, like that's terrible that, you know, people are being exploited to that level. Mm. But the upside of sustainable fashion, I suppose, is also that you keep your money in your pocket because so many of us, you know, we're click, click happy and we're getting, you know, parcel after parcel in the post and a lot of it we might never even wear.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. And we are buying the wrong sizes and we are buying stuff we don't, when we try, it doesn't look exactly like, you know, we looked on the website. So we get frustrated and never get to wear. So ideally you would try and pass that on, you know, to a friend, to a family member, you would try and resell it. There are great websites for you to resell. You would bring to a charity shop, obviously, if it's in good condition. But, you know, the best case scenario here is for you to wear what you have and then, you know, add a few pieces here and there as you go, but not necessarily just, I suppose, this reckless thing of just buying tons of clothes just for a weekend, just for a post on social media and never again. You know, that disposability, this is obviously good for nobody.
Absolutely. And we've seen some images over recent months of, you know, landfills just piled with clothes, Pat, and that really kind of brings it home when you see all those clothes and where they end up. That's the seriousness of it. Pat Kane, mm-hmm. sustainability expert and founder of Roosie, a sustainability lifestyle shop. Thanks very much, Pat, for your time. One last message before I go. This comes in from Barry. Hi, Cuiva. I'm 68 on my next birthday later in the autumn. I'm staying working as it's great routine and it gets me up early 5 days a week. I'm only working 25 hours a week, so it's not exhausting. My motto is stay going while you're able. P.S. I hope I have your name correct. Yes, thank you very much, Barry. And there you go, Barry, working hard at 68 years of age. And yeah, look, work keeps you young and it keeps you going strong. So if you can and if you want to, why not? Listen, I'll be back at the same time tomorrow.